Welcome to another episode of SharkBites.net, where we delve into issues of tech leadership in the public sector. Please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts or simply go to SharkBites.net. Here now is our host, Dr. Alan Shark, Executive Director of the Public Technology Institute, now a division of Fusion Learning Partners.
Hi there, everyone. This is Alan Shark, and welcome to another episode of SharkBites.net. This is a first. We've been doing this for some 4 years, and for the first time, we are going to have a co-host. So I'd like to introduce you to Mary Frances Coriel. Mary Frances, welcome.
Thank you, Alan, for having me. Excited to learn more about this podcast and meet interesting people from all over the country involved in technology. So again, thank you for having me today.
Well, it's really a pleasure. I met Mary Frances a while back. She is the Vice President of Revenue for CityBot. And CityBot, if you recall, has appeared on this podcast twice now over the last number of years. First, when I guess it was just getting its start, and more recently, as a result of reacquainting with one of the founders. And it's a good podcast because now they're dabbling very well with artificial intelligence, that nasty AI word. But we're really delighted to have Bob Leak. Bob, thank you for joining us. Bob is the Clark County Information Technology Officer. You oversee a team of some 200 employees. You have worked previously for a smaller county, Multnomah County in Oregon, which includes Portland, Regional IT Director for Healthcare Company of Kaiser Permanente, Application Development Director for Egghead Software. I guess I'm going to date myself. I remember Egghead Software. I used to go to the physical stores, and it was quite exciting. You have had tremendous experience managing large capital projects, developing strategic plans, implementing systems. You have more than 30 years experience, and you came to the county right after or right during the pandemic. Is that correct?
Hi, Alan. Yes, I joined Clark County in the last year of the pandemic before restrictions started to loosen. And I moved here. Mask on, driving down from Portland, finding a place to live, getting my kids in school, and joining what is by some measures about the 10th largest county here in the U.S.
So it's an exciting place. I visited your offices many years ago. You have an awesome responsibility. I can't imagine what Las Vegas would look like during a pandemic. I mean, it's both good and bad. It's like, wow, it's nice and quiet. But yeah. Then again, there's no revenue coming in.
No, and unemployment rate was north of 40% at the height of the pandemic. It looked like some of those movie scenes, the post-apocalyptic movies with no traffic on the strip. I remember distinctly seeing an image of a tumbleweed. I don't know if that was staged or not, but that was the reality here for quite some time. And one might wonder whether in the face of another pandemic-like event, if the same decisions would be made given knowledge now and the impact that had on the local economy for sure.
And that's true on so many different economic areas. So I always ask this question because it helps shape the person that you've become. I mean, you've had 30 years of IT experience, public sector, private sector. So my first question is, what got you interested in technology? Was it, you know, something to do with parents, school? What was it that attracted you, or did that come later?
No, it came really early for me. I was really fortunate to grow up in a small town in North Carolina, Mount Airy. That's Andy Griffith's hometown. And went to an elementary school, maybe 150 or so kids, with some really thoughtful and impactful teachers and administration that got computers really early on. Those of us of our particular age demographic will remember the TRS-80. Oh, and yeah. We had a classroom, a computer lab set up with those. And in third grade, I got the opportunity through an advanced placement testing and some aptitude testing and just my own desire and curiosity to begin to dabble around with those TRS-80 machines in the lab. Ended up doing quite a bit of my math homework on a computer.
My first computer was a K-Pro 2. So that was like the Doom box that was this big metal suitcase that I thought was really cool with double-sided disks.
Right.
What an improvement, right?
Yeah, yeah. My father had one that had a tape recorder that you pushed play and record on while you were doing your coding.
So you were an early adapter, and you've had tremendous experience, again, in the private sector. What attracted you to the public sector? That's quite a change.
Yeah, it was. This in Portland, Oregon, I had finished up about 10 years worth of work with Kaiser Permanente there in the Northwest. The last role I had there was as the CIO for the hospitals. We built the first new hospital in the Portland market since the 1970s or so. That was on the west side of town. It was a growth area, certainly for Portland in general and for Kaiser Permanente's client base. And started to think about what's the next challenge and really didn't want to move out of the region. I could have stayed with Kaiser, probably gone down to California where the various motherships are located and probably had a great career with them, but thought, let me take a look around. I'm actively involved in the IT community in the Portland market through the Society for Information Management and some other professional development programs, and ran across a position as the deputy CIO for Multnomah County. Knew a few people that were working over there, got in touch with the leader at that time, Sherry Swackhammer, sat down and talked with her quite extensively, and discovered that she was really looking to put a succession plan together. And I thought, well, I have at that time 20 years of IT experience across different industries, and bring a very solution-oriented mindset to the role. Not having government experience, I was also uninhibited and unrestricted by the traditional approach to government technology. And you know, the word stereotype exists because there are stereotypes that exist. And I thought I could bring a different mentality to that role, given the background that I had. And went through the process, extensive rounds of interviews and discussions, was able to step into that role as the deputy CIO. And then upon Sherry's retirement, went through an internal recruitment and was granted the role as the CIO. And really what attracted me to it is the same thing that I find now that attracts people to public service. It is the aspect of making a difference in people's lives. It's the knowledge that as I look out my window and see a large portion of the 2.5 million people that live here in Clark County, that what we do every day makes a difference in their lives. And that really does, it draws me to the work. It's not the social mission. You know, I have such respect for caseworkers and everybody that works with families and youth. It's not the courts and the legal system. It's not law enforcement. It's not the fire and public safety organization. It's not the airport. You know, those are all the operations and the businesses that we run. What I love about the role that I have is that our team touches all of that. We're one of those few organizations like HR and finance, the procurement organization. We're involved in everything. And that's a fun way to get up every morning, to know that I essentially work for 38 different companies all at the same time.
I find that fascinating. So starting as a deputy, did that help, I guess, grease the skids, better prepare you to take on the top job? I mean, you're lucky because sometimes you're just thrown into the fire. You kind of knew what you're getting into, I take it.
I did. And I think moving from the role that I had at Kaiser, pretty high profile, big visibility with the hospitals there, and kind of taking a deep breath for a minute, stepping back, knowing that I could be part of a succession plan, but I never once assumed that I would be the CIO. It's a self-driven motivation for myself. Many of us that are high performers, we tend to hold ourselves to maybe an even impossible standard. I know it's usually called, we hold ourselves to a very high standard, and I certainly do that as well. And so the ability to go around with Sherry and go to meetings and really learn the public sector, because she had an extensive amount of experience in the public sector, to learn the how the public sector operates differently, and to learn by having a little bit of a less risky profile, but getting things done, getting some really large projects up and running and off and running, including an ERP replacement, which is usually the pinnacle of many people's public sector career. I've done that 3 times now, and there may be one on the horizon for us here at Clark County too. Being in that deputy role and being given a significant set of responsibilities and performing against that, and then learning what that next high level job or that topmost job as a technology leader in a large organization like both Multnomah County and Clark County are, I think it was a great way to be ready to step into the role. At the end of the day, you still have to bring your gifts and your skills, and you have to be the right person in the right situation. I am confident there are counties and cities that I couldn't work for, but the two that I have been a really good fit for me.
So the stars lined up for all parties.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I once worked for somebody who said, if you become a deputy for too long, you're never going to want the top spot. Because you get used to the fact that, you know, let the other person, you know, take the arrows. I want to be involved with the operations. And he really made a point, and it forced me to move ahead in my career. It worried me because I did want to lead something. But if you're a deputy too long, you're going to be a deputy forever. And that may be fine if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've always had a plan toward achieving an executive level position. That was the basis of what I wanted to do. And I have an accounting degree, and obviously then, you know, moving out of college, the path was toward a CFO position. That's the path that I wanted to be on, and learned luckily early enough on that audit and tax weren't really things that I liked doing. And so shifting directions and moving more in the technology direction, and knowing that ultimately I wanted to be in an executive level role, and just build my skills and build my network and do the hard work that it takes. Because I also always said, I want to be a candidate for an executive level role. And by being the best candidate, if they grant me the opportunity to take the role on, then I've done all the preparations possible to get there. And frankly, I'm not sure where my Peter Principle is yet. I don't think I've gotten there yet.
I hope you never find it. So, so you know, they say, I was thinking there are really three types of, I guess, backgrounds that really help to really fortify success in the CIO. And you have one of them. You have many of them. But the three that comes to mind is an accounting background, because it is a discipline. There is a routine. There is no BS. It is straightforward in terms of what you have to do, when, and be apprised of all the regulations, and taking that to the IT and RENA, that's compliance. The other one, believe it or not, is music. Again, very similar to accounting in the sense that you have to account for the next note, just like you have to account for the next account. The third one actually is GIS, because that the skill sets today really take somebody's ability to really master data, not just for the sake of data, but data outputs. So anyway, when you were talking about accounting, I thought, wow, that's really cool.
No, I appreciate that. I hadn't heard it put into those perspectives. And so it may explain a little bit why I do love picking a guitar up and having it on my lap, but I'm not sure that I can get music to come out of it.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you, let's talk about technology and what your plans are at Clark County. In other words, some of it has been predetermined, I guess, from your predecessor. But where are you headed? But Mary Frances, I see your hand is up, so jump in.
My hand is up. Before we jump into that, I was hoping, Alan, that Bob could tell us a little bit about that journey in regards to moving from a county with 800,000 people to now the county that's in the top 10 in the country. I mean, you're looking at 3 times the size of the population. I can only imagine the complexities and the structure differences. So yeah, tell us how you went from one to the other.
Yeah, it is interesting. Certainly scale is different between Multnomah County and Clark County, But structurally, I have found a lot of similarities. And where that comes to light is Multnomah County, by some measures that I remember, is about 40% of the state of Oregon, and both population and economic driver wise. Here, Clark County is about 70% of the economic driver and population of the state of Nevada. And so, so structurally, there's some similarities. There's also only a handful of cities in Multnomah County. Now, it's the smallest county in Oregon, and so it doesn't have the sprawl and spread of some of the other larger counties. So it's not surprising that there's only a handful of cities. But here in Clark County, there's only five cities as well. Now, one everyone recognizes is Las Vegas, but North Las Vegas, Henderson, Boulder City, and then about 90 minutes northeast of us is Mesquite. And so from a geopolitical perspective, I don't think there are any plans to add any more cities. We'll see how all of that plays itself out over time. And so what's been great about that transition is to have that foundation kind of honed in Multnomah County on 2.5 times less scale, but to bring the same approach, which is rooted in collaboration, rooted in long-term strategic thinking, which is also something that I have found with many of my peers. They're happy to get through one legislative cycle, let's say at the state level. Here in Nevada, the legislature only meets every other year, and so the impacts are less frequent, but more meaningful, because you have to plan for a year to spend a year with the legislature in order to get at the state level the types of investments and work that's needed. And Tim Galluzzi, who's the state CIO, is doing an incredible job in pulling all of that together across the state. But you can also, with about 20 people in a room, get your hands around the vast majority of the thoughts that are needed, both statewide, but certainly here in Southern Nevada with a regional approach. And so that's what we do. My peers and I, we get together, we talk and identify places where we really should work together. So take digital identity and identity management and verification. No one recognizes when they drive between unincorporated Clark County, which has about 1.1 million people, and the city of Las Vegas, which is about 700,000 people, right? We don't stop you at the county border to double check your credentials. But from a digital perspective, it would be great if we kind of rethought and retuned what it is that we try and provide to the public in terms of services, and unmask and unconstrain that there are certain services you get from the city versus services that you get from the county. But from a digital identity perspective, you know, when you log into Amazon, you log in once and you have access to hundreds of thousands of products and tens of thousands of companies. I think that same thought approach could happen for the residents of a county. And if we do this really well in a state our size, you know, there are states on the eastern half of the country that this might be really difficult to pull off. But for us in Arizona and Utah, I think Oregon to a great extent, Idaho for sure, and a handful of others, I think if we take a collaboration-based approach where we have a long-term strategy on how we can deliver services to the public, I think we're not as constrained as people might think we are, but we have to do it planfully.
Yeah, that was a good question, Mary Frances. And I think it has to do with leadership and mindset, mm-hmm. because that wasn't always the case. Two things come to mind. I remember doing a consulting gig for the U.S.'s oldest planning commission. There were two counties. And I won't mention them right now, but they're right outside of Washington, D.C. And we were there. I should have worn black and white referee shirts. I didn't realize they were neighboring counties. Mm-hmm. And it was a park authority that brought them together, a planning commission. They had their own police. They had their own GIS systems. They had their own radio channels. And they had their own mapping, which meant that, if that's your point, if you're riding through a park, you don't care if the park ends at the border of the other county. You would like to have a map that gets you from one point to the other, regardless. There was no such way when we got involved. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that would happen today. I think what I see changing, and I think you're a perfect example of that, is people are looking for something different in terms of qualities of leadership when it comes to technology, especially in government. It's soft skills, which I hate. I hate that word. Let's just say professional skills, an emphasis on collaboration. And I would have to say, Mary Frances, and you've seen this too, it used to be a time, even with PTI, my organization, that the vendors had to be in another place. We wanted their sponsorships, but well, we have to have a firewall. And now, in particular with COVID, there has been this outpouring of cooperation that I've never seen before, which we welcome. I think it's the greatest thing. So what you're talking about is working with, counties and cities in your region, area, state. I think that's a trend that has to continue when we are competing for scarce resources. And then we have the vendor community. Mary Frances, you've been in the private sector too. Have you seen that phenomenon from your vantage point?
100%. And I think the biggest piece of that boils down to, from a technology perspective, technology is just continuing to grow and grow and grow. And when we look at the private sector and we look at vendors, it's unrealistic to say that they can be an expert in all of these things. And we've seen time and time again where a vendor has, tried to go down a new product path or a new line of work, and then they quickly pull back and say, "What are we doing? That's not what our expertise is." So with that, we are seeing within the market where, yes, there's greater collaboration, there's greater partnership. And what that's really leading to, in my opinion, is better products, better services, because there is this open line of communication. And so it's not, I'll say, entrepreneurs just building things in a vacuum that they personally think is really cool. It's actually like solving problems, understanding the features, meeting the customers where they are today to ultimately take them maybe where we want them to go in the future, but not moving into a lot of tech debt, which is another thing we've seen in the past where these vendors just build so much tech, but their market is not even ready for it yet. So there's definitely a newer feeling of collaboration and conversation.
Which I think is very healthy. So, Rob, tell me about your plans. What excites you the most about some of the new projects you're working on?
Yeah, it's never been a better time to be in, I think, in civic technology. The availability of solutions, there is some consolidation that we see happening in the market with some of the larger organizations coalescing around a more full portfolio. Kind of the I might call it the ERPization of government services. But within that, what we are tuning into, and this has been great too, we have a new county manager that was installed about 18 months ago, and he is embarking on an effort now with our 38 departments to build an updated county strategic plan. You would wonder, well, why would a county need a strategic plan? You just, you operate on a day-to-day basis, you take care of what's right in front of you. But we have an intentional outcome around making lives better in the communities that we provide services to. And so, if any plan will get you there, that would be one approach. But a plan that gets you to a specified set of desired outcomes is the approach that Clark County is taking. So within that, each of us was asked to put together a one-page plan. You could only have three items on it. Now, my project portfolio right now is about 230 projects. So to boil those down to the three most important would do a disservice to the departments or the efforts that aren't on that list of the top three things. So I broke the mold and I said, okay, I'll give you three things. Number one for us is cybersecurity. At the end of the day, as we've seen jurisdictions around the country struggle with maintaining continuity of their operations, that is something that we take really seriously and have made tremendous investments in. And so the aspect of ensuring that our services are up and running and that we have business continuity planning in place and that we have, back to Mary Frances's point, great partners to work with, that if something happens, predetermined plans and actions that we would take and so forth, has been our top priority for a handful of years now. Second, though, is do the big stuff. And so I boiled the 230 projects down to the top 10 list. 9 of them are business projects. 1 of them is a technology infrastructure project. And that's because I firmly believe that over 80% of a portfolio of a CIO in government should be focused on their business outcomes. And that I know there's an adage that says there are no IT projects, and I'm not sure I agree with that. I think there are IT projects when you think about the network, or you think about the device programs, or emerging technologies that we want to explore before they have an unplanned for impact on our operations. And so our list of top 10 projects include some legacy system replacement, include some digital transformation activities, another one of those buzzy terms that's out there. But really what we're focused on is how do we continue to support the delivery of better and better services to the public, leveraging technology for those outcomes. And then my third category is do the small stuff. And so we have a number of pilots and efforts that are going on around artificial intelligence, or what I like to call augmented intelligence or augmented capabilities. And we're doing all of that around this concept that I'm big on simple models. And so my simplest model of our services model is persona driven. And we have residents that are a persona, and we have business owners that are a persona. And that's the two core things that we want to bring our systems together around, this concept of helping residents and helping business owners be successful and thrive in the community. The other two personas we work with are our own employees, but employees at the city and the state as well, and bringing them a toolkit and a set of tools that allow them to be remote workers if their work allows for that, and to have a great experience at work. And then the fourth persona is visitors. We're going to see another record year of visitation here in this region. I've heard different numbers quoted, somewhere between 43 to 53 million. Doesn't matter. That's just a ton of people that are coming to Las Vegas. Las Vegas is back in terms of the convention area. The professional sports franchises now that call this market home. And then the wealth of things that you can do beyond the entertainment and gaming industry, in terms of getting out into nature, the hikes, the Red Rock preservation area, everything that's available to folks. And so when you only have to work with four personas, it just makes the world seem a lot simpler. Now we can talk about, so within a resident, what is a group of those individuals? And so our social service programs would be one way to look at that, or the justice involved population would be another group that we could look at that. And don't they deserve the best in the services that we could provide? And so so that's kind of how we've organized our work. Three big strategic goals are centered around these four personas.
And you got a passing grade for that. Boy, that's great. I thought you were going to say, you know, C appendix B for, you know, and siphon off all that stuff. That would, I've never seen someone brilliantly put together 200 things into three categories.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I have a lot of help here. I have lots of really good ideas, and then a great group of people that actually pull that stuff off.
So 2 years, 3 years from now, you look back, how would you say this was successful? What is your measures of success?
I think one is certainly tied to our continuity of operations. And so if we're successful in our cybersecurity work and in our infrastructure work, and we keep the services running, then that's a key measure for success. And I think about some of my peers around the country who have been impacted by disruptions to their services. So that's a key success measure. And then I think I put them in the three categories. That's one. The second one is our business outcomes. And so if we have a business outcome around economic diversity, and we want to see organizations moving to the region and bringing new types of companies, bringing a workforce along with them. And so whether that's biomedical, or that's pharmaceutical, or manufacturing, you know, things that aren't traditional for what Las Vegas is known for internationally, And at the same time, retaining the universe's leading place in terms of a destination. That's how we describe it ourselves, and we want that industry to continue to thrive, obviously. And so, a set of the business outcomes, let's say. And then for us on the IT side, we have a set of core metrics, KPIs and OKRs and, you know, all the right things that a CIO should have, maybe not quite at my fingertips yet, but we're trying to simplify our world too, beyond just uptime and availability, but things in terms of measuring those business outcomes, you know, issuing a business license. How do we make that go faster with less friction? How do we reduce the number of steps, and how do we reduce the time it takes at every step in the process? So that's how we talk with our business partners about bringing technology to bear. It should be tied to some really tangible business outcome. And at the same time, I'm watching in my operations and infrastructure to make sure that we're healthy and that we're doing the necessary work and making the necessary investments so that all the rest of that work can be done successfully as well.
It sounds like success is already here. You know, one of the things, a couple of things you said that sparked some comments on my end. One I want to make, you referred to the operating departments as business partners. And I just want to emphasize, I think that was very intentional. Mm-hmm. One of my dear friends, who is the chair of our leadership council, Adam Frumkin from Franklin County, Ohio, mm-hmm. he always reminds everyone, don't call them customers, because for years, the departments were customers of the IT department.
Right.
And he actually sends some of his staff to be certified in business relation management. Mm-hmm. The whole idea being that these are our partners. And when you treat them as partners, the results are so much better.
Yeah, we just put 55 people through a similar program for exactly that reason. The other thing that we never call the folks that we work with are users.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other thing you said, I've done a lot of work on artificial intelligence, as Mary Frances knows. Mm-hmm. And I've been saying, and it was just, I saw her eyes light up when you said augmented intelligence. Mm-hmm. I have a whole slide on the difference between AI that most people are talking about and the AI that you and I are talking about. And it really is augmented. Now, it very well could get worse, mm-hmm. where we lose control. But right now, I'm comfortable with augmented intelligence. That's the AI that I work with.
Yeah, and we have a set of proofs of concept that we're working through, about a dozen of those right now. And they cover the gamut of various types of use cases, to use that technology term. And a couple of the most promising areas that I see are around translation services. Mm-hmm. The state did pass a law that we need to start doing our work in the language of those that we're providing the services to. And I think AI is going to so rapidly advance from a translation capability, where I can picture maybe even by the end of this year, the ability for the folks at our desks that interact with people in person, mm-hmm. That they can have a universal translator in their ear. And I know the technology is there, because I have a couple of those that I'm test driving myself, where you can speak in your native language and I hear it in the language I want. And then if I hand you an earpiece, I can speak in my language and you'll hear it in your native language. And I think that that is going to make a tremendous difference in the quality of the services that we provide to each other. And remembering from my days at Kaiser Permanente, where medical terminology is hard to translate into other languages, and that's true. If you're just trying to get a building permit with us, there's not a lot of technical language involved. But the misunderstanding that can happen about the steps that you need to take and right. the process that you're going to go through, doing that in one's native language, I think it's just going to be revolutionary in the quality of the services that we're able to provide. And then the quality of life for our employees, who aren't going to be frustrated through that. And certainly for the people that we deliver services to, they're going to know much more about what it's going to take to be successful with us. And so I'm very high on translation services when it comes to the advances that AI is making. And then we have a number of process improvement projects that we're doing, digital assistant projects. I'm kind of glad we didn't really do chatbots to any extent, because I think we're going to skip over them and really do digital assistants as the way to navigate our service models and to interact with us both online, on a smartphone footprint, and the ability for us to use these, this emerging technology. And again, we're not going to be out on the leading edge. We're going to let some other organizations kind of set the pace, but we're going to be a close follower to use that that component of kind of being versus a leading edge versus being a laggard. We're going to be closer to the leading edge, but I think we're going to be just behind some of the organizations that are really going to push this technology in some really great directions.
I like that strategy.
I'll leave with just the comment of human connection. As I was just listening to this last piece that you guys were talking about, my head was in this space of whether we're talking about strategic initiatives or KPIs, it all begins with that human connection and, listening to those business partners, fostering those conversations. So I love that we were here today to talk about technology, but we're landing in the place of human connection at the end.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing your time. I have two reasons now to come your way. One is to meet with you in person, and the other is I do want to be at the Sphere. That just fascinates me.
Yes, we will welcome you anytime you want to come. And remember to bring a little bit extra and throw something down on one of the tables. I mean, at the end of the day, we do really appreciate people leaving some money behind.
I do it in other ways. Bob, I can't do that. I'm not a gambler, but I love the meals. I love the shows. They do get my money one way or the other. That's
excellent.
For sure.
That's
okay.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing your time. Mary Frances, thank you for joining me as co-host. And we look forward to many more episodes. And we'd like to perhaps circle back with you, Bob, and just see how things are going maybe a year from now or so.
Would love that. Thank you so much, Alan. Thanks, Mary Frances.
Thanks, Bob. Take care.
For those joining late, we've been having a wonderful conversation with Bob Leake, who is the CIO of Clark County. And if you hear another voice, it's Mary Frances Coriel, who is a Vice President Revenue for CityBot. She will be serving as a co-host on a number of our episodes moving forward. So we hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you've got a story to tell, by all means, let us know. And as we always conclude our podcasts, please be safe, both personally and digitally.
You've been listening to another episode of SharkBites.net. Please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts or simply go to SharkBites.net. And if you or someone you know has a story to tell, please let us know.